Chapter 39. Sorry figure if placed inside the field woman's wrapper upon a monotonous acreage of turnips on a dull day. He had never till now estimated the artistic excellence of Tessa's limbs and features. If he were only to appear in a ballroom, he said. But no, dearest, I think I love you best in the wing bonnet and cotton frock, yes, better than in this, well as you support these dignities. Tessa's sense of her striking appearance had given her a flush of excitement, which was yet not happiness. I'll take them off, she said, in case Jonathan should see me. They are not fit for me, are they? They must be sold, I suppose. Let them stay a few minutes longer. Sell them? Never. It would be a breach of faith. Influenced by a second thought, she readily obeyed. As he had something to tell, and there might be help in these. She sat down with the jewels upon her, and they again indulged in conjectures as to where Jonathan could possibly be with their baggage. The ale they had poured out for his consumption when he came had gone flat with long standing. Shortly after this they began supper, which was already laid on a side table. Ere they had finished there was a jerk in the fire smoke, the rising skein of which bulged out into the room, as if some giant had laid his hand on the chimney top for a moment. It had been caused by the opening of the outer door. A heavy step was now heard in the passage, and Angel went out. I could make nobody hear at all by knocking, apologized Jonathan Cale, for it was he at last, and as it was raining out I opened the door. I've brought the things, sir. I am very glad to see them. But you are very late. Well, yes, sir. There was something subdued in Jonathan Cale's tone which had not been there in the day, and lines of concern were plowed upon his forehead in addition to the lines of ears. He continued, we've all been gullied at the dairy at what might have been a most terrible affliction since you and dear Miss Esso, to name her now, left us this afternoon. Perhaps you hadn't forgot the cock's afternoon crow? Dear me, what, well, some says it do mean one thing, and some another, but what's happened is that poor little Reddy Priddle have tried to drown herself. No. Really? Why, she bade us goodbye with the rest, yes. Well, sir, when you and dear Miss Esso, to name what she lawful is when you two drove away, as I say, Reddy and Marion put on their bonnets and went out. And as there is not much doing now, being New Year's Eve, and folks mops and brooms from what's inside them, nobody took much notice. They went on to Lou Everard, where they had summit to drink, and then on they vamped a three-armed cross, and there they seemed to have parted, Reddy striking across the water meads, as if for home, and Marion going on to the next village, where there's another public house. Nothing more was seed, or heard already till the waterman, on his way home, noticed something by the great pool. 'Twas her bonnet and shawl packed up. In the water he found her. He and another man brought her home, thinking he was dead, but she fetched round by degrees. Angel, suddenly recollecting that Tess was overhearing this gloomy tale, went to shut the door between the passage and the anteroom to the inner parlor where she was, but his wife, flinging a shawl round her, had come to the outer room, and was listening to the man's narrative, her eyes resting absently on the luggage, and the drops of rain glistening upon it. And, more than this, there's Marion. She's been found dead drunk by the whitey bed, a girl who have never been known to touch anything before except chilling ale, though, to be sure, a was always a good trencher woman, as her face showed. It seems as if the mates had all gone out o' their minds. And is? Asked Tess. Is about house as usual, but I do say I can't guess how it happened. And she seems to be very low in mind about it, poor maid, as well she mid be. And so you see, sir, as all this happened, just when we was packing your few traps, and your missus's night rail and dressing things into the cart, why, it belated me. Yes. Well, Jonathan, will you get the trunks upstairs, and drink a cup of ale, and hasten back, as soon as you can, in case you should be wanted? Tess had gone back to the inner parlor, and sat down by the fire, looking wistfully into it. She heard Jonathan Cale's heavy footsteps up and down the stairs till he had done placing the luggage, and heard him express his thanks for the ale her husband took out to him, and for the gratuity he received. Jonathan's footsteps then died from the door, and his cart creaked away. Angel slid forward the massive oak bar which secured the door, and coming into where she sat over the hearth, pressed her cheeks between his hands from behind. He expected her to jump up gaily and unpack the toilet gear that she had been so anxious about, but as she did not rise, he sat down with her in the firelight, the candles on the supper table being too thin and glimmering to interfere with its glow. "I am so sorry you should have heard this sad story about the girls," he said. "Till, don't let it depress you. Reddy was naturally morbid, you know." "Without the least cause," said Tess. "How they who have cause to be, hide it, and pretend they are not." This incident had turned the scale for her. They were simple and innocent girls on whom the unhappiness of unrequited love had fallen. They had deserved better at the hands of fate. As he had deserved worse, yet she was the chosen one. It was wicked of her to take all without paying. She would pay to the uttermost farthing. She would tell, there and then. This final determination she came to when she looked into the fire, he holding her hand. A steady glare from the now flameless embers painted the sides and back of the fireplace with its color, and the well-polished andirons, and the old brass tongs that would not meet. The underside of the mantel shelf was flushed with the high-colored light, and the legs of the table nearest the fire. Tessa's face and neck reflected the same warmth, which each gem turned into an Aldebaran, or a Sirius, a constellation of white, red, and green flashes that interchanged their hues with her every pulsation. "Do you remember what we said to each other this morning about telling our faults?" he asked abruptly, finding that she still remained immovable. He spoke lightly perhaps, and you may well have done so. But for me, it was no light promise. "I want to make a confession to you, love." This, from him, so unexpectedly apposite, had the effect upon her of a providential interposition. "You have to confess something?" she said quickly, and even with gladness and relief. "You did not expect it? Ah, you thought too highly of me. Now listen. Put your head there, because I want you to forgive me, and not to be indignant with me for not telling you before, as perhaps I ought to have done." How strange it was. He seemed to be her double. She did not speak, and Claire went on, "I did not mention it, because I was afraid of endangering my chance of you, darling, the great prize of my life, my fellowship I call you. My brother's fellowship was won at his college, mine at Talbothays Dairy. Well, I would not risk it. I was going to tell you a month ago at the time you agreed to be mine, but I could not. I thought it might frighten you away from me. I put it off. Then I thought I would tell you yesterday, to give you a chance at least of escaping me. But I did not. And I did not this morning, when you proposed our confessing our faults on the landing, the sinner that I was. But I must, now I see you sitting there so solemnly. I wonder if you will forgive me? Oh yes. I am sure that, well, I hope so. But wait a minute. You don't know. To begin at the beginning. Though I imagine my poor father fears that I am one of the eternally lost for my doctrines, I am, of course, a believer in good morals, Tess, as much as you. I used to wish to be a teacher of men, and it was a great disappointment to me when I found I could not enter the church. I admired spotlessness, even though I could lay no claim to it, and hated impurity, as I hope I do now. Whatever one may think of plenary inspiration, one must heartily subscribe to these words of Paul. Be thou an example in word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity. It is the only safeguard for us poor human beings. Integer vitae, says a Roman poet, who is strange company for street Paul, the man of upright life, from frailties free, stands not in need of Moorish spear bow. Well, a certain place is paved with good intentions, and having felt all that so strongly, you will see what a terrible remorse it bred in me when, in the midst of my fine aims for other people, I myself fell. He then told her of that time of his life to which allusion has been made when, tossed about by doubts and difficulties in London, like a cork on the waves, he plunged into 8 and 40 hours dissipation with a stranger. Happily I awoke almost immediately to a sense of my folly, he continued. Would have no more to say to her, and I came home. I have never repeated the offense. But I felt I should like to treat you with perfect frankness and honor, and I could not do so without telling this. Do you forgive me? She pressed his hand tightly for an answer. Then we will dismiss it at once and forever. Too painful as it is for the occasion, and talk of something lighter. Oh, angel, I am almost glad, because now you can forgive me. I have not made my confession. I have a confession. To remember, I said so. Ah, to be sure. Now then for it, wicked little one. Perhaps, although you smile, it is as serious as yours, or more so. It can hardly be more serious, dearest. It cannot, oh no, it cannot. She jumped up joyfully at the hope. Oh, it cannot be more serious, certainly, she cried, because 'tis just the same. I will tell you now. She sat down again. Their hands were still joined. The ashes under the grate were lit by the fire vertically, like a torrid waste. Imagination might have beheld a last day luridness in this red coaled glow, which fell on his face and hand, and on hers, peering into the loose hair about her brow, and firing the delicate skin underneath. A large shadow of her shape rose upon the wall and ceiling. She bent forward, at which each diamond on her neck gave a sinister wink like a toad's, and pressing her forehead against his temple she entered on her story of her acquaintance with Alec d'Urberville and its results, murmuring the words without flinching, and with her eyelids drooping down. End of phase the fourth. Phase the fifth. The woman pays, XXXV, her narrative ended. Even its reassertions and secondary explanations were done. Tessa's voice throughout had hardly risen higher than its opening tone. There had been no exculpatory phrase of any kind, unless he had not wept. But the complexion even of external things seemed to suffer transmutation as her announcement progressed. The fire in the grate looked impish, demoniacally funny, as if it did not care in the least about her strait. The fender grinned idly, as if it too did not care. The light from the water bottle was merely engaged in a chromatic problem. All material objects around announced their irresponsibility with terrible iteration. And yet nothing had changed since the moments when he had been kissing her, or rather, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.